Whether you pack your school lunch in a bag, a box, a tiffin, or a tin, bringing food from home is a way to carry a bit of your family identity with you. It can comfort you or set you apart from others. It can nourish you or make you want to trash your sandwich. It can fill you with memories or make you want to forget where you came from. Or sometimes, it does all of that. Welcome to Digesting Food Studies, the podcast that packs a pretty tasty set of midday treats into a 30-minute bento, while also encouraging you to trade snacks with your classmates. I'm your Dabawala and DoorDasher, David Santo. This episode unpacks the packed lunch, in particular those that the kids of first-generation immigrants bring to school. Although we've already talked about the evolving federal school lunch program in Canada and Indigenous territories, there are many angles on this hot subject, including the important connection between home food and familial identity. Two articles are in focus this time around, one from Volume 8, Issue 3 of Canadian Food Studies, and the other from Volume 12, Number 2, published in October 2021 and September 2025, respectively. We start off with Alexia Moyer's multi-perspective take on lunchboxes, both literary and personal, including some pretty fascinating points about industrial design. We also take a brief walk down memory lane, albeit interrupted by a tearful stumble. And then I talk with Yukari Seiko about two articles she has co-written for CFS, the first about Japanese families' experiences during Canadian school lunchtime, and the second about those of Chinese and Indian families. Both take a fascinating and generative, arts-informed research approach. Finally, in the aftertaste, we hear from University of Saskatchewan PhD student Shay Quinn, who offers an additional set of thoughts on meaning-making and engagement in food-centered research for participants and researchers alike. Well, hello, Alexia. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks, David. How are you?
I am good. Question for you before we start this little amuse-bouche, but related. Did you ever see the movie The Lunchbox?
I have indeed. It's a great one. I highly recommend it.
It's a love story through little tiffins that people use to carry their lunches to business executives in India. And the star, Irfan Khan, actually died a number of years ago, but he was a wonderful actor.
Oh, yes. Yes, I've seen him in a number of films, but The Lunchbox remains one of my favorites with him.
We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Anyway, tell us about your version of Lunchbox Tales.
Yes, because we're really going to focus on this food travel related receptacle today. It is a container designed to carry a packed lunch. And the first recorded use of the term was in 1862 in Harper's Magazine. The story within is a story about Elliot, who carries a lunchbox on his back. He is accompanied by someone named Dot, who carries a reticule. It's a name for a small cloth purse. And Hal, who carries an atlas, but what he really wants is a knapsack. So clearly, this is a story about having the right kind of carrying equipment. Now, there are other such containers that essentially perform the same function. We have the bento boxes, we have the tiffin carriers that are the star of the lunchbox film that you mentioned. And owning and making use of such a box or a bag presupposes that there is no system in place on site. People and equipment and food and funding to provide a lunch. And the making of that lunch occurs offsite.
Food from home.
Exactly. Now, the main challenge of the lunchmaker is to prepare food that is travel-friendly, portable, so that it keeps a certain temperature, so that it doesn't get damaged during transport, so that it doesn't spoil. The lunchmaker may also be thinking about budget, prep time, and even seasonality.
There's a huge amount of stuff that goes into, I mean, all parents know this, making lunches in the morning or whenever they're being made is very time intensive and also very intensive of attention.
Yes, attention and intention. A particularly travel-friendly food that goes into the lunchbox is something that goes within a pastry casing. There are so many examples of this where the pastry is actually the food carrier.
Right, yeah.
And it becomes a self-contained meal. So I'm talking about hand pies and pasties, turnovers, empanadas, samosas, sausage rolls, The Cornish pasty is the one that really initially came to mind for me,
yeah,
which is typically filled with meat and vegetables. But historically, it has been known to have the savory course on one side and the dessert on the other. So you kind of worked your way through your courses.
Yes.
The pastry.
Fantastic. And then that, the ridgy edge bit of it where it's been crimped. It was also sort of too thick to eat and was kind of the handle it could be disposed of at the end because the coal miners' hands who were eating these things would have been too dusty with coal dust.
And speaking of lunch modifications for miners, there is a lunchbox that is made in Sudbury, Ontario since 1956 that was designed by a miner, Leo May, and it was designed to hold the weight of a person and the lunch within.
Wow. So a super structurally solid chunk of metal that you could sit on as well as keep your food in.
And a very necessary one if you're working out in the field and you don't have access to seating. And so whatever shape or field that happens to be, this lunchbox has its applications.
It also suggests that, you know, we think about now getting food on the run. We often eat while we're standing up. I eat very often my food around the kitchen counter at lunchtime, so I don't waste the time of sitting down. I put waste in giant air quotes. But it's interesting that, you know, a lunchbox that you could sit on is an explicit valorization of taking the time to sit to eat.
Yes. It's also interesting to think about industrial design and how it shows up in our everyday experiences. So other elements of industrial design that show up here are those insulated food jars, which allow for a hot lunch or, let's be honest, an almost hot lunch.
A warmish lunch.
The other item, which I hadn't given much thought to, it is not a food item, but it's the lunch note.
Yes.
It's something that we have remarked in other children's lunches with pictograms for non-readers, messages of support and encouragement, or a food pun like you are super.
Oh.
Or you are one in a melon.
You're going to cure me of my desire to make food pun jokes.
Those are just for you, David, because I know you love them.
Thank you.
You can even outsource the labor by purchasing ready-made notes. So all of the thinking and the writing and the coloring has been done for you.
Oh, good. Does ChatGPT now have an option to replace parenting with an online app?
Yes, let's see, shall we? So lunch notes are, of course, yet another thing to show off your parenting skills or be quietly judged for the lack of them. And it turns out upon consultation that our youngest does like a lunch note saying that she likes to have a word from home to see her through the rest of the day.
Oh, your kids like you.
I think so. So then this idea of what we put in the lunch, like cultural foods. And here I'm using a term that Yukari Siko et al. Use in their article to describe those diverse, dynamic nature of food practices tied to the cultural background of the eater. That said, the prized item in our collective family lunchbox can be anything from bon bagnat, which is a tuna niçoise salad in an olive oil soaked bread, to flammenkuchen, to onigiri, to stuffed grape leaves, to a raspberry clafoutis. So only some of which line up with our cultural backgrounds. And then there's the outside container that holds the food jar, the cutlery, the note, the couscous salad. But my question for you, David, is, do you have a lunchbox, or is there a lunchbox in your lunchbox toting experience that stands out to you?
Completely. I'm thinking about the lunches I ate as a kid, and they were not nearly as interesting as your kids' lunches. Semi-tepid Chef Boyardee ravioli in a thermos, which I stopped eating because it was so disgusting and probably will cause me some dread disease someday. No, but I remember very well after that thermos full of ravioli, I actually got a Steve Austin, so a Bionic Man, orange lunchbox. I was so proud of it. I was a very timid child. I felt manly carrying around my Bionic Man lunchbox. And one day, yes, I was skipping home from school carrying my Bionic Man lunchbox and tripped and fell. And the lunchbox made out of brittle plastic flew in front of me, landed on the sidewalk and broke. And I cried and cried and cried. And I thought, yeah, okay, I might feel manly, but I am not certainly looking very manly, sobbing as I bring my dilapidated Steve Austin lunchbox back to my mother and tell her that it can't be fixed at all. It still will make me cry thinking about that little boy who was traumatized by breaking his lunchbox.
What you actually needed was a miner's lunchbox, which would have withstood that.
Of course, the irony now is I should have said to my mother, we can rebuild it. We have the technology. And I didn't think about it. And I was just crying.
I like that we both had a prized orange lunchbox with a television character on it. Mine had Care Bears. I'm still attached. And it was a real thermos one where the top of it became the cup and it had a handle on the side. And I have fond memories of that Care Bear lunchbox.
Well, I think both of us have just completely given away our age. Oh,
yes.
Well. I will think about this story fondly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Yukari Seiko is an associate professor in the School of Professional Communication at Toronto Metropolitan University and director of TMU's Center for Studies in Food Security. Her research focuses on critical health communications, arts-informed practices, and youth mental health, including the food experiences of new arrivals to Canada and their offspring. Yukari, thank you so much for joining us on Digesting Food Studies. We're talking about lunchboxes in schools today. You have two articles from Canadian Food Studies that we'll touch on, but I'm really interested in the bigger picture of the work that you do and this whole notion of what happens when you are eating food in an elementary or high school when you are not necessarily from the dominant culture and what that looks like. So tell me about this research and how you started looking at the idea of lunchtime food in elementary schools and high schools.
Well, sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me here, David. I'm very excited. So maybe I can talk about my general research interest. It's about the culture of food insecurity and diasporic foodways among migrant families in the Greater Toronto Area. More specifically, I'm fascinated by exploring how migrant families navigate dominant food culture in Canada. So for these two early carols, we focused on the children's homemade lunches to school as a site of negotiation over families' food practices, social locations, food norms, values, moral accountabilities, and perhaps most importantly, perception of what healthy eating looks like.
And you use this location of the child's lunchbox as a kind of intersection between home life and home food life and school food life. And then all of the discourses and practices and shaming and celebration of different cultures that happen within the school context. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like really like the bento box is a, such a cultural artifact that comes like, it's like a small cosmos coming everything into one place. Myself, I am a first generation immigrant from Japan. And I'm a parent of a Canadian-born son. Mm-hmm. When he was 5 or 6 years old at senior kindergarten, one day he came back home and said, like, can I bring a sandwich to school for lunch? Mm. And I was like, yeah, of course you can bring a sandwich, no problem. But, like, you love onigiri, which is Japanese-style rice ball. Why are you saying that?
Had you been packing more traditional Japanese-style lunches for him up until then?
Because that's what I get used to it, and he loves it, right? That's what he, that's his normal, like, you know, yeah. That's a bento, that's a lunchbox, right? And he was like, no, my friends start teasing me. I bring sushi to school every day, and so I start hiding my food. Why you have to hide your lunch while you are eating favorite food? So that's a starting point.
So it comes from a very personal place. This was your own experience. Then it turned into the two articles. So one that was published in 2021 talks about Japanese families in Canada. And the more recent article, it's called Feeding Children While Asian. I love that title. But it's also about South Asian, Indian families and Chinese families too. So you've expanded the scope of research to a variety of different cultures.
Exactly. The first pilot study was like very small Japanese immigrant families and stemmed, as you say, from my very personal experience witnessing my son facing lunchbox shaming. It was like a moment when I clearly understood and embodied the feminist slogan that personal is political. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is that just me? Or can I expand this thing? And I started speaking to my friends and colleagues. And it turned out, no, actually many things. You know, many people are experiencing like their favorite lunches were called stinky, gross, disgusting. And it impacted heavily on their food identities. So in the second study that we just published, we actually extended to Chinese and Indian communities to see if these lunchbox shaming experiences are prevalent across these communities as well. And it actually does, you know. Yeah.
Well, and it's fascinating that in a city as multinational as Toronto, I mean, I guess lots of things happen in elementary schools that are not so positive, and there's lots of shaming that goes on in a variety of ways, not just about food. But it is so we celebrate the multiculturality, the multinationality of Toronto and of Canada in general. And yet there's still all of this stuff going on for new arrivals or the kids of immigrants, which is, again, not entirely surprising, but kind of sad given how delightful most people think it is to experience other cultures' food.
I would say like a culture is always dynamic. And if you encounter with something that you are not familiar with, like children's reaction that what is that? And like, you know, there's like very normal reaction to it. The whole point here is there is a dominant culture in the Canadian school food environment, and in which some of children feel like they can resonate better with dominant food cultures, while other children feel like, oh, my home food culture is quite distinct from what is normal in Canada. And this is why it's very important to talk about National School Food Program.
Right. As we move towards instituting the National School Food Program across the nation and in very different cities and regions and places, this has to be a major factor that we pay attention to, because a school food program could very easily just exacerbate the problems of shaming.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Like our two articles highlight the key role culture plays in feeding children in Canada. Current discussion on National School Food Program is centered on ensuring equitable access to nutritious food, which itself is extremely important, but little attention is paid to whether the meals provided through National School Food Program are culturally appropriate to children and their families, or reflecting their cultural preferences, changing needs, and stuff like that. So, as you say, like lack of culturally appropriate food options can affect dietary needs and impact students' cultural food identity.
Sure, because if the food is not appropriate to one's culture, it might not get eaten, and therefore it is not nutritious by kind of by definition. If it's not going into a body, it's not providing nutrition. It's a nexus of issues that can't just be about a dominant culture's interpretation of what is nutritious or what is good. I mean, I think about what's happening in my home province of Quebec, where there is a great deal of momentum towards enforcing, well, different words are used, but effectively the assimilation into a kind of standardized Quebec culture. And for people who are coming to this province for the first time from other places, forcing that through food would be a terrible thing. There is risk of really creating a whole new layer of problems and other layers of social isolation and shaming and differentiation.
But in the meantime, we also have to consider National School Food Program can be a great platform to talk about what the Canadian food identity can look like. And to me, it's a lot of different things. You know, just as Canada is so diverse, and it could be like reflecting local diversity, local cultures, and changing what the immigrant families bring to Canada, and then mix with fresh ingredients available in Canada, like, you know, like, for example, like blueberry lassi, blueberry yogurt drink that's so famous in Vancouver, or like a sushi pizza, you can see it here. Mm-hmm. Like, all things are just the beauty of Canadian culture. Then the question is, why we are always feeding children like pizza, mac and cheese, lasagna, which is actually like, you know, local regional food. So like, what exactly Canadian food identity looks like is such an interesting question. And National School Food Program has a tremendous potential to discuss this very important question for all of us.
Well, and to enact some really smart food systems change potentially. This is such a key moment in the future of Canada, but in the future of how school food programs, as you say, can engage with local food culture, local production, short production chains, food education, so that kids actually understand where food comes from again. I think this is so interesting, and it's so important, the work that you're doing. And I hope that it has some kind of influence on policy. So let's hope that it finds the ears of the politicians who are creating the programs that feed our kids.
Yep.
Let me ask you a somewhat different question. You've taken an arts-based approach or an arts-informed approach to doing the research. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's fairly unusual in a lot of food studies research.
Yeah, arts-based or arts-informed method. It basically, you use arts to stimulate conversation with your study participants. In my case, children. I love the arts-informed method of collage making and drawing because children for this paper unboxing the bento box and also the feeding agent, children created beautiful lunchboxes using craft papers, stickers, markers, and they told us a really great rich story. You can find the pictures of their work in our 2021 article on bento box and also a new one as well.
Yeah, so it's really a way to evoke storytelling through material rather than sort of forcing kids to be research respondents and just use their words. And it really shows results in the actual article. We get insights that we might not get if we had just asked questions of the kids.
I strongly believe we have to do this study with children, not on them. Mm-hmm. And then if we wanted to do the study with children, we have to provide the means so that children can feel comfortable telling their stories at their own pace in a safe space. And interestingly, parents too say that they learned so much new things from children's artwork.
Oh, I bet.
Like they are like impressed that, you know, okay, like I always trying to pass my traditional food values to my children. And I could see that how my children make our lunchbox in a very balanced way, like vegetables and meat and like, you know, these things. So they're very proud of children's art making. Yeah.
That's fantastic. So it in fact sort of loops back some kind of feedback to the parents as well. It's not just research for research sake. It's research for the kids' well-being, for the parents' understanding of their kids, and crossing your fingers, getting those policymakers to listen to kids' voices and hearing what they actually need and want.
Yep. Researchers can do a lot of things to stimulate the conversation within the household, within the communities, and so that, as you say, we can deliver our community's voice to the ears of policymakers.
Yeah, please. Let's hope. So where are you going next with this? Is this going to continue as a series of articles? Are you going to be working more on lunchbox shaming and lunchbox opportunities?
At this point, like my research going to the very interesting direction. While researching with children from migrant backgrounds, I became interested in the other end of life spectrum, older migrant adults.
Oh, interesting.
So both groups. So I interviewed a Japanese Canadian older adults. Both groups have limited food agency and often rely on other people to feed them physically, financially, psychologically. So I've been researching about cultural food insecurity among older first-generation migrants, especially from Asian backgrounds, especially through Congregate Community Dining Program and Meals on Wheels food delivery service.
Ah.
In the end, I feel like we can connect these two sides of, you know, life spectrum providing, like, you know, we can think about procurement of culturally appropriate food through some community-based food procurement model.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to read the next articles then. Thank you so much for telling us about this, for sharing your work, and for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Shay Quinn is a PhD student in Communication and Population Health Sciences at the University of Saskatchewan. Their research uses arts-informed methods to examine how Indigenous youth think about and express ideas about traditional foodways.
My name is Shay Quinn. I'm a PhD student in Community and Population Health Sciences at the University of Saskatchewan, which is located on Treaty 6 territory in the homeland of the Métis. My research is focused on Indigenous traditional foodways and meanings using arts-based inquiry to explore how Saskatchewan youth define traditional foods in the context of school food programming. This article meant a lot to me, not only in relation to my own research, but also in my experiences as somebody who grew up in Canada with mixed cultural heritage. The author's positionality is very apparent because the article is comprehensive, rigorous, well-written, but what stood out to me the most is that it has an important message told in a heartfelt and meaningful way. And to me, that's the heart of dialogical phenomenology, telling a story. I'll briefly summarize a few key ideas and perspectives that really spoke to me in the article. The first key takeaway I had from this article was the importance of meaning-making through innovative methods. Arts-based inquiry has so much value in being accessible because it can transcend language, ability, age, cultural barriers through artistic expression. But it also creates something impactful for not only the researchers, but also the participants. For example, if my son had participated in a study like this and shared with me his artistic rendition of his favorite food, and it was a cultural dish I had made for him, that would really mean a lot to me. So I think there's a lot of value in that dialogue between what is important to participants and what's important to the researcher. Another key takeaway I'd like to highlight is the importance of capturing youth perspectives in their own words and in their own expression. As the authors emphasize, there's a lot of power in conducting research with children rather than just on them. I think many people that read the study might have a preconceived notion about what lunchbox shaming looks like in a contemporary classroom. Certainly I did, and it seems that the adult participants in the study did as well. However, when the kids get a chance to tell their story, when these students get to share what their lived experiences are like in a contemporary classroom with cultural food, you get a really nuanced perspective on what it is we're dealing with and where we go from here. The final takeaway I'd like to highlight can best be summarized by a quote from the findings section of the article. Notably, there was no external facilitator for parents that would encourage them to pack cultural food in school lunches. Now, without breaking down the data analysis procedures in too much detail, essentially this means that when cultural foods are included in a school lunch, it's done so because that's what the family wanted to do for one reason or another. This elicits two thoughts for me. One, how very incredible it is that culture can be carried from one generation to the next through persistence and resilience and love. Those parental figures that wake up at 5 a.m. to cook a meal for their kids or search for recipes online or modify family recipes to adapt to their new home, they're not just caring for their children, they're honoring their culture and their ancestors. And that's really beautiful. The second thought I have is something that the authors conclude with, as I will as well. Any forthcoming school food programming and policy has to consider the inclusion of traditional and cultural foods, and that needs to come from the perspective of the families themselves. It really wouldn't be truly Canadian cuisine if it didn't.
If you went to primary or secondary school, I expect something from this episode will resonate with you, at least when it comes to school lunchtime, that is. Certainly plenty of TV shows and movies have also visualized that experience, and generally to a rock and roll soundtrack. Our schools are already plenty fraught as spaces of socialization, and when you layer in the systemic complexities of food, they become even more so. So many opportunities and needs present themselves, demanding more research into school food, lunchtime shaming, home food and identity, student success, and lots of other questions. It's tempting to make puns and jokes about these subjects, but really, school food is as critical as excellent teaching, safety and acceptance, and funding and support for programs that reach the diversity of our very pluralistic student populations. Thank you so very much to Alexia Moyer, Yukari Seiko, and Shay Quinn for sharing their lunchbox stories and for caring so much about this subject. Digesting Food Studies executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Take a look at the show notes for links and references, and please do take a moment to like, review, and subscribe to the podcast. And if you're packing a lunch tonight for your kid to take to school tomorrow, include a note from me, and maybe some goldfish crackers. What a lot there is to be found inside a school lunchbox. Sure, there are the wax paper-wrapped sandwiches, the nori-wrapped onigiri, and the mylar-wrapped granola bars, a thermos full of tepid soup, maybe, and a baggie full of baby carrots. If you're lucky, there's a note from a parent, a tradable treat, and a sense of being cared for. But you can also find identity, and design, and shame, and nutrition, and a handful of marketing, a fun-sized bag of legislation, and a snack pack of peer pressure. Is it any wonder that school cafeterias are sites of tensions, alliances, and negotiations and waste? Will they forever figure as settings for food fights, both literal and figurative? Or can they also be our home away from home, an extension of love and belonging, and the place where we learn to sit together in harmony?